welcome to Storytellers Campfire. We have been sharing some wonderful programs here at the Campfire. We've been introducing very new and entertaining shows for our listeners. Recently, we have featured the Charlie Checkers Show, On the Line Public Interest News, the Summer Reading Program, and Story Tales, which features short stories and sometimes long tales. But today, we are featuring a brand new show, Don't Give Up Your Daydream, Transitions in a Transitioning World. We hope you enjoy this program.
I'm your host, John Knuckle. I'm a private equity advisor, slash author, and now new radio host. Welcome, my fellow creative professionals, to Don't Give Up Your Daydream, where creativity and drive meet experience and guidance. This is our first show, and I'm so excited to get started. Our goal is to introduce you to guests who have gone through major transitions in their lives or careers and have landed in a better place. All of them have kept their creativity alive, and that has been vital to their success. It's a thrill to have David Lender as my first guest. David is a former investment banker and current best-selling author. He has 7 novels and a collection of short stories available now. And I just read his latest thriller, Spin Move, and I knew he would be number one on my wish list to have on my first show. Welcome, David.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
So how are you? How you been?
I'm good.
Good.
Working hard. I've got a new novel going. I was writing before the show here.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you, what are you working on now? Before we get into our interview, let us know what you're working on.
Sure. I have 2 series. One is Sasha Del Mira, which is a spy, espionage. She's like a James Bond ninja.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a white-collar crime series, which was the Spin Move was part of that. So
yeah.
I'm working on my next book in the Sasha Del Mira series. My first was Trojan Horse and then Arab
uh-huh.
Summer. And
yeah.
So this will be my third in that series.
I really loved Arab Summer, by the way, also. I think I said that to you before.
Thank you.
Yeah. So now here's the thing. We want to get people to try to think about transitions. We want to help them. So how does someone go from being an investment banker for 25 years to a best-selling author? Did it take, it took like a month or so to make this transition?
How
does it all work?
At least a month. I had really wanted to be a writer when I was young.
Uh-huh.
And so it was, and a novelist. And that was something that when I went to college, that was something I worked very hard at. I was an English major. I took a lot of writing courses, but when I got out of school, I decided to take a different route. And I got very interested in the stock market, went back to business school, and that's how I became an investment banker. But being a writer was something I'd always harbored as a long-term objective. And I had just moved to New Jersey with my then-wife from the city, and I had a big house with an office, and I said to myself one day, you know what, this is as good a time as any to write that first novel. And so I would get up every morning a little earlier than usual before my commute into the city. I would get up about 5 a.m. and I would write for an hour before I would mm-hmm. go to work. And so that's really how I got going, and I just made I made it into something where I was just going to grind it out. And I'm a pretty organized person and kind of a plugger.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote my first book that way. So really
when
without
you first started writing, waking up like at 5 in the morning, you had in mind that you were writing a novel. You weren't just practicing or working on your craft. Okay.
No, I don't believe in practicing. I mean, writing is, you know, writing is writing. So
yeah,
I was just going to write the book.
Yeah, no, that's good. So to do this, to take this extra time every day, to wake up early every day, you know, what inspires you to do that? Like, what gives you that drive?
Well, I think that's kind of how I approach everything in my life. If I decide I want to do something, I do it pretty much whole hog, or I'm not going to do it at all. So, and I'm fairly disciplined, pretty broadly across whatever I do in my life. So I just decided. I mean, really, the big decision or the inspiration was to say to myself, I'm going to write the novel. And then once I'd made that decision, it was a question of how was I going to organize myself to do it. And I was working full-time on Wall Street doing mergers and acquisitions, which is a consuming profession.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I was traveling a lot. At that time, I was working for the Rothschild Family's Investment Bank, so I was doing a lot of international travel as well.
Wow.
So you know, I just needed to make sure that I shoehorned somewhere into every day, you know, at least an hour or so of writing. And then it became more than that, because once I got started, I'd be taking a cab home, and I'd be making notes, or I'd be outlining a scene for the next day. And so it just sort of built on itself, too.
So this, you were just consumed, I guess, not just with work, but with writing. So you were just, like, every waking moment, you were working, essentially, or working or doing
something.
Yeah,
but that, I mean, a career as an investment banker, you know, people would always ask me how many hours a week you work, and it's just, like, not possible to even answer that, because you're always doing something working on a deal.
I know. You're the guys that have the black cars are lined up outside the building at 11 o'clock at night. Yeah. Yeah, no, I know.
And that's the car I would take home from the office and have the little light on in the back the whole way while I'm waiting to get through the Lincoln Tunnel, and I'm outlining a scene or I'm editing stuff from the day before.
Yeah, but see, what makes you different from the other guys where they were sleeping in the back and you continued to work, right?
Yeah. You know, like I said, I made up my mind I was going to do it. And so I finished my first book in about a year, I think. Maybe it was 18 months. I just don't really remember precisely.
Yeah.
And I had a good friend at the time whose brother was a very accomplished literary novelist. And he offered to have his brother take a look at it for me, which he did. And he gave me some very good feedback, which was basically, consider this a master of fine arts and put it up on the shelf in your bedroom closet. He said, I think I've got a couple of them up there still in my closet, and then move on to the next one. He said it was, you know, half memoir, half three different novels. He said, you got to just start on the next one now that you got this out of your system. So I did.
Okay, so this is the part I think that separates you from a lot of people, and that's why I wanted to have you on. You know, so many people start doing something, they get rejection, or they're afraid to have someone read their work. Now, what is it, once you worked on this, you know, coming home late at night and all of that, and then someone knowledgeable reads it and says, okay, well, we'll start again. I mean, how do you deal with that? A lot of people would just hang their head and, you know, and be done, or at least be set back for a while.
Well, at the time, I didn't realize it, but because it was my first book, but if you want to be a writer, you have to learn to deal with rejection, and you have to learn to deal with criticism. And I don't know, maybe there's something just different about my makeup where I have always, in wanting to be a better writer, I have always sought out people who are knowledgeable and you know, willing to teach me. And I want them to tell it straight. I don't want, you know, I don't want a friend of mine to read the book and say, wow, this is great. I want...
Yeah.
Even though I do have some people in my life, my wife and my mother-in-law in particular, who are just totally bluntly honest with me about things in my writing. And you need to have that. My first editor would write stuff, you know, when I finally got an editor, which is a little further down the road, and my wife at the time would look over my shoulder and she would just laugh. She said, "I can't believe he's saying that to you." But I said, "But he knows what he's doing, and he's right."
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, so certainly with writing, and if this is a more general audience where people aren't going to necessarily be writers, I mean, I think anything you're going to do where you don't know what you're doing, and it's a goal you have to learn how to do that, you got to find people who are going to be critical of you and not nasty, but who are going to tell you you're doing it wrong, or,
yeah,
or you can do it better, or something like that.
Yeah. I found I know a lot of people when I talk about writing with other writers, and a big thing is people saying, I'm nervous to have people read it, or I'm nervous to have people judge me, or it's my art. I don't care what other people think. That's so counterproductive. I'm sure you'll agree.
Yeah, that just doesn't work. It's silly. I mean, whether it's writing or anything, if you want to learn how to do something, how can you learn to do it if you can't find people who know how to do it to tell you how to do it? And, you know, and writing is a little different because it's, you know, it's not black and white. But there's some elements of it that are black and white. If you write a crappy scene, you know, that's just flat and there's no emotion and the characters are boring, I mean, that's kind of universal. Nobody's going to want to read that.
That's
and I don't think anybody...
a note on a trumpet, right? You know, everyone's
going to
hear
it. It's either wrong or not. And if it's wrong, you got to fix it.
Yeah. What about, do you ever have a writer's block, or do you ever have a time where, because this will relate to, you know, we're trying to speak to all creative people, obviously, but is there a time where you just can't come up with an idea, or, you know, sometimes I just don't feel like doing it sometimes.
I don't really understand writer's block, because I never have periods where I can't come up with an idea. I have, you know, a ton of ideas. And if you can't come up with an idea, just read the newspaper and it'll give you an idea.
You
know, what's happening in current events, or you read something about your subject matter. I mean, it's so easy now. When I started writing, you know, we really didn't have the internet. I had the librarian at Rothschild did a lot of research for me. She was terrific. She could find anything. But, you know, today you can just Google it. But I don't have any trouble with ideas. I have trouble sometimes with just putting my butt in the chair and forcing myself to write, because you just that's what I have to do. I mean, I get excited about writing a scene. Generally, when I write, I just write scenes. You know, I think in terms of scenes. And once you get flowing, it frequently just goes. It comes out like, you know, liquid flowing. But most of the time, I have to force myself to sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write this scene today. And sometimes it's torture. It takes you three or four times as long to get through it as it should, because you're just having to force yourself. But like I said earlier, I'm a grinder, and I don't look at writing as a fluid creative process. It's a structured, organized part of the workday.
Yeah. I remember some writer saying once, my wife doesn't understand. When I'm sitting at my desk staring out the window for 2 hours, that means I'm working. And sometimes that's what you're doing, you know?
I would take issue with that. If I'm staring for 2 hours, I'm not working. I gotta get something done in two hours.
Yeah. I've learned to nap sitting down or sitting up, so maybe that's what it is. Now, you mentioned to me that you don't like to read other thrillers while you're writing.
Yeah,
now that's
I
agree with that. But is there someone, authors that you really like, or that you like to would like yourself to be grouped in with? You know what I mean? That type of thing.
Yeah. Well, actually, there's one writer that I can read when I'm writing, which is Elmore Leonard.
Okay.
And that's only if I'm writing in that mode with that sort of the white-collar crime thrillers that I write, because they're increasingly more irreverent and not entirely serious, whereas the spy stuff, you know, that you can't write it that way. At least I can't. But Elmore Leonard is probably my favorite. No, he is definitely my favorite contemporary writer. And I regret that he passed away recently and a couple of years ago. And I've read almost of everything of his. And you know, I guess what I'll have to be satisfied with is rereading some of it because he won't be putting out any new stuff. I've always have admired F. Scott Fitzgerald, and I once said to somebody, I'd love to write a novel like The Great Gatsby. I'd love to be able to write like F. Scott Fitzgerald. And somebody once said to me, well, why don't you? I said, because I can't write like F. Scott Fitzgerald.
He's F. Scott Fitzgerald. I want to paint the Sistine Chapel also.
Right. You know, if I could write like that, I'd write like that.
I remember someone
mostly
once,
thrillers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, someone once wrote a review of The Great Gatsby. And it was recent, and talking about how it wasn't really an important story, and it wasn't, you know, this didn't make sense. And I'm thinking to myself, like, how do you critique something that's beautiful? You know what I mean? Just the words are just so beautifully put together. It's just such a foolish thing to try to critique F. Scott Fitzgerald. It really is. But anyway. So F. Scott and Elmore Leonard. That's pretty interesting.
And I read Le Carre. I like Graham Greene a lot. He's not really, I would call, specifically a thriller writer, but, you know, he writes a lot in that genre. He also wrote literary-type fiction. Grisham I still read once in a while. I think the best thriller ever written is Frederick Forsyth's The Day of the Jackal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, unbelievable.
And maybe up there with that is 3 Days of the Condor.
No, these are great, great books. Great, great books. These are the books that we read when we were younger, or, you know, with me, I was commuting on the train and reading a book, you know, just about every 2 weeks, finishing a new book, reading all these thrillers. And I think for a lot of people, these are the building blocks for why they want to write, you know?
No, yeah, I mean, there's no question. I don't see how you could want to be a writer if you don't love to read.
Yeah, absolutely. These are like the Miles Davis and the Eric Claptons and the Beatles of writing, you know?
Yeah.
It really is great stuff. And if you haven't read any of these books that David mentioned, go read them, please. Now, did you get formal training, like how to put together a story? Where? Go ahead.
No, not until I hired an editor. I mean, that was when I wrote my second book. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of reading of books on writing, which helped me a lot with learning how to structure a novel. Because when I wrote my first book, I didn't have, you know, there was just no structure to it. I just started writing. And I was outlining, and I was, you know, I was doing it in an organized fashion, but I had no training. And so I finished the second book, and I had a dear friend at Rothschild, a guy named Sidney Grusin, who was in the office next to me, and he was in his 80s by then. He was a senior advisor. He was a former vice chairman of the New York Times, and he knew everybody. And so he said, if you want, he read my second book. He said, I really like it. It would make a great movie. Do you want me to send it to some agent friends of mine? I said, what, are you kidding me? Of course. So he sent it to a bunch of very prominent literary agents in New York, one of whom was, I learned after the fact, was one of the most prominent literary agents in New York. And she actually read it, and she called me up and said, you know, this really isn't bad for somebody who doesn't know what he's doing. And if you would like to learn, I can introduce you to some people who can teach you. So she gave me the names of 3 thriller editors, one of whom was a guy named Richard Marek, who was Robert Ludlum's first editor. Mm-hmm. He edited Ludlum's first 8 or 9 novels.
Okay.
And so I said, what, are you kidding me? I mean, this is a guy who can teach me how to write a thriller. And he did.
Yeah.
So I would meet with Richard probably once a week, once every 2 weeks, and we'd have lunch and talk about it. And he, you know, I was always mailing him my revisions. Over the period of 18 months, he taught me how to write a thriller. And that became, my second book became the first book I released, Trojan Horse.
Yeah, it's, you know, and dealing with the rejection. Well, one of the things I wanted to say, and what you just said reminded me of it, and I'm going to go a little off the script here, but we met because I sought out you, just like you sought out these other people. And I want the listeners to know that, you know, as you're trying to do your next thing or make your transition into your next step, whatever it may be, don't be afraid to ask for help. Now, I know you're too modest to talk about this, so I'm going to tell the listeners, I was struggling myself with my first book in the same stage that you were at, and I didn't know what to do. And I just went on websites of all the authors in my genre. And I went on their websites, and I contacted them, and I asked them if they have any advice or like to meet. And, of course, you were nice enough to actually meet me for lunch. Now, we met right outside of Grand Central. I'm sure,
right.
You know, you were on your way to Grand Central, so it worked for everyone. But I do remember what you told me, and I don't know if you remember what you told me, but what you said about my first book was you have to put your stake in the ground. Like, you have to, you know, it's like you made the analogy of the Oklahoma land rush where you had to run out and, like, put your flag in the ground, and that's where you are. And that's what I did. And from that point on, everything rolled you know, I guess pretty well. So ask for help, people. That is a very important point. So here you are. Now you finally feel like you're starting to get rolling, right? How many rejections did you get? How many times were you rejected, do you think?
I can't count them. I took the traditional publishing approach, and I would send out query letters, and, you know, you read a book on how to write a query letter, and you have somebody look at it for you, and you, I mean, hundreds and hundreds, certainly, and could even have been 1,000, I don't know, over a period of years. So, no, I had a finished novel that was edited by a professional editor. And I got some contacts from Richard. But that was the process. You couldn't submit it to a publisher without having an agent.
Yeah.
And I didn't want a crummy agent. Mm-hmm. I wanted a good agent, so I started at the top, and I worked my way down. And then I started going to this thing called Thriller Fest, which is a group of people that get together and they talk about thrillers and they have presentations and they have an element of it called Craft Fest, where the established authors give classes in certain types of things. And then they also have a thing called Agent Fest, where a bunch of agents come in and you get, I think it's 6 minutes to pitch your novel.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of little desks in these rooms, and people are lined up by these agents, and you get 6 minutes to pitch your novel. And in fact, to prepare for Thriller Fest, I read a book by a Hollywood development guy, it was called Selling Your Story in 60 Seconds. It was how to do a verbal pitch.
Okay.
And on a whim, I saw his phone number in the back, and I called him, and he picked up his answering machine, and we talked, and he said, yeah, I'll coach you through that. So I hired him as a consultant. It wasn't very expensive, and he taught me how to do a pitch. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that, he said, at the end of the coaching, he said, you know, and I had to give him the outlines for my books. I had two books I was pitching, because the first book I wrote, I made into a novel after I learned how to write one, and that became my third book I released, called Bull Street. But he said, I can help you punch up these outlines. You know, I'm a script development guy. This is what I do for a living. And I can help you make these into better stories, which I hired him to do. And so that helped me improve both of my books. But in the pitch process, I got to the stage where I realized, you know, I was still working at the time, and I would say to myself, would I hire this person if I was in my day job? And the ones that wanted to take me on, I didn't want to hire them. You know, why do I want some doofus representing me, or somebody who's, you know, poor at follow up and crap like that? This is, you know, this is a serious thing for me. And once you take an agent on, you know, you're locked into them for a while.
Yeah.
So I never got off the ground with that. I never took the traditional publishing route.
Okay.
And it was,
okay.
Now,
this is what I wanted to, this is very important, and I think this is something that would be good for the readers to hear, but I want to wait till after our commercial break for you to talk about, you know, the solutions. Because we've all, you know, as far as rejections, you know, this, if anyone's transitioning into something, you know, you're going to go on 100 interviews, you're going to send out letters, and I think I shared this with you once. I read where some author, you know, became an overnight success, but the real backstory is, you know, she got rejected 137 times. Now, I remember thinking, wow, I wish I got 137 return letters. You know, they didn't even bother to reject me. They just ignored me. So we're going to get into that in the second half, but now let's go to a commercial. And when we come back, David's going to continue. And like any good thriller, we're going to leave you with a little cliffhanger till the second half. And we'll be back soon. Stay with us.
More than 1 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Can be fun, but it isn't fun if you get hurt on the job. Wear the proper safety equipment. When you're working outside, drink plenty of water, and don't be afraid to ask for help from your coworkers. Remember, your boss is responsible for your safety. Know your limits and your rights. Work hard and be safe. For more information, visit OSHA.gov or call 800-321-OSHA.
A message from the U.S. Department of Labor.
Welcome back, everyone. For those who have recently joined us, I'm your host, John Knuckle, and you are listening to Don't Give Up Your Daydream radio show. We're focusing on transitions in the transitioning world. When we last saw our intrepid hero, David Lender, he wasn't hanging from a cliff, but he was about to go back to the drawing board after, I believe it was, 18 months of working on his third novel that would become his first novel. I think I have it right. Right, David?
It was the second that would become my first released.
So now here you are, you know, you've put in a lot of work, man. You really are, you really put your shoulder down and put in the time. And, you know, you put in a lot of work, and you're still really, you know, you don't have a book yet, do you?
No, I mean, I have two books, but I don't have...
No one knows you have a book.
I don't have nothing published.
And
this was around the time that the Kindle was just becoming a phenomenon, the electronic book.
Okay.
And my younger brother is a computer guy. That's what he does for a living. He's very savvy with this stuff, so I guess he would have been what you would call an early adopter of the Kindle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Who got it and said, all right, I see how this is an interesting platform. And so he asked me for a copy of Trojan Horse in a .mobi format. And
okay.
I said, right, what's a .mobi format? I said, I've got it in Word. He said, well, the .mobi format is what you read on a Kindle. And I said, right, what's a Kindle? Because I didn't have any idea what it was at that point. And ironically, so I sent him the thing in Word. He put it in .mobi and put it on his Kindle. My birthday was, I think, a month later. And just coincidentally, my wife bought me a Kindle for my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And in the intervening space there, I said to myself, well, what's this all about? So I did some research into what a Kindle was and what ebooks were and all that. So I was beginning to get familiar. My birthday is in early November. So between early November and the middle of January, and this would have been January 2011, I educated myself sufficiently and worked with another friend of mine who was a post-production guy with creating a cover, and got my Trojan Horse converted to be read on the Kindle and got it uploaded into Amazon's Kindle Direct Publishing. So I'm going to bypass the traditional publishing route and just throw it out there and see if I can promote it, see what happens. So that's how I got my first novel up there, and I got really lucky with it. I think I had it priced originally at $9.95 alongside the authors that I admired, and it took me about 2 weeks to realize that, you know, I sold maybe a half a dozen books, that that was maybe not a great strategy.
Yeah.
So I started dropping the price, and this was a time when a lot of indie authors were pricing their books at 99 cents. So that's what I decided to do ultimately, and I did that at around the same time that I had a promotion. You know, you can buy space on these newsletters that are targeted at ebooks, and a lot of them specifically at Kindles. And I had a promotion that worked pretty well for me, and I sold a couple of hundred books in a 2-day promotion, something like that, at 99 cents. And I remember getting up the next Saturday morning, and I looked, because Kindle Direct Publishing, you can check real time, like every hour they update what your sales are. And Saturday morning, between like 9 o'clock and 10 a.m., I had sold another 100 books.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, that's great. And then I checked an hour later, and I'd sold a couple hundred more books, and then, you know, a couple hundred more and a couple hundred more. And finally I started looking around, because I know how Amazon's master software promotes, even though I don't think anybody understands that black box.
Yeah.
I think what must have happened is they have all these things like movers and shakers or trending up, and their software picked up my book.
Wow. So
as
you
something
got into
that
the
was
Amazon
trending.
Algorithm, huh?
Yeah, the algorithm grabbed me,
and
my mother-in-law got the email. I didn't get it, but they
send
out blast emails, and it was four new mystery and thrillers, and there was one big one in the center and three small ones across the bottom, and Trojan Horse was right there as the prominent one, and that book took off, and you know the thing hit the top 10 at one point. And I started getting calls from real agents, and it was amazing.
Wow, yeah.
And that book stayed there. It was the number one, the category was spy stories and tales of intrigue. It was the number one in that category for like a month, I think.
Wow.
What I did
book,
was...
It was a great book, by the way, but go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What I did was I had another book that I had started a year or two earlier, that I released as my second book, called The Gravy Train, which was a variant of the first book I wrote, which was released as the third, which is Bull Street. The Gravy Train and Wall Street and Bull Street are both stories of young Wall Streeters getting embroiled in various machinations and, you know, learning the business, and then they wind up actually having their lives threatened. One's about an insider trading thing, and the other's about a bankruptcy case where the Wall Street sharks are trying to take this guy's company over and steal it from him. So at any event, I realized that the successful indie authors at that time were pricing at 99 cents, but they were also getting a lot of books out there just to feed their readership.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did, is I released in pretty quick succession Gravy Train and then Bull Street within, I don't know, 3 to 6 months apart,
oh,
something
wow.
like that.
So you
and,
jumped on the momentum. You seized on the momentum.
Yeah. And at the same time, I got contacted by a publisher called Thomas & Mercer, which
mm-hmm.
is an imprint of Amazon's publishing division. I got contacted by one of their senior editors there saying, you know, we love Trojan Horse and we'd love to take you on as one of our stable of authors.
Uh-huh.
And then he explained to me all the various advantages of being, you know, under their umbrella. And the model is totally different than traditional publishing. I didn't have an agent to go through them.
Yeah.
And the deal you get is quite substantially different than the traditional
mm-hmm.
publishing model.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a lot of promotion. So I said, what the heck have I got to lose? So I had written my... was writing my fourth novel, which is called Vaccine Nation,
mm-hmm.
Which I edited back with Richard Marek again, by the way.
Oh, okay.
And I released that in November of through Amazon's, through Thomas & Mercer,
mm-hmm.
in November of 2011. And what they also did was they took the first three books and re-released them through themselves. So
yeah.
they have the rights to those three now as well.
So you are, you know, I don't know if, it almost seems like you had a game plan going in, but going back years, but I'm sure you didn't. But if you think of the way this came about, you sought out help from people who were already in the industry. You weren't shy about asking for help. You sought help of established professionals. You made sure that you worked with good people. And
right.
I think the biggest, most interesting thing is you adapted to changes in technology. Now, so many people out there are having, this is a big problem. Now, you know our backgrounds. I worked on the trading floor for years, and technology
yeah.
basically closed, shut it down. Now, so many people would sit there and gripe and groan and say, oh, well, what I used to do, they do on a computer now. Well, what do? You adapt. You adjust. You did that just, organically, without thinking about it, without... Now, do you think that comes from your background in business, or is that from, just your personality? Because I'm trying to think of, for a listener to think what in their background, what they do can help them make adjustments to this, this changing scene in front of us,
Well, I think one of the reasons I was successful was that I did have a career in business, and I looked at writing as, in part, it's a business. And, I really applied myself to learning the ebook business and how just the mechanics of it work, but also how you can promote things yourself. And I did approach it as a business. At the same time, I think there's something in my personality, maybe that helped me be successful in business, where I have some degree of adaptability,
mm-hmm.
So that I can adjust to things as they're happening.
It is very hard. I see people. The technology thing is big, and I think one of the things we want to do with the show is, through your experience or other people's experience, allow listeners to adapt it to their life. Like, you walk into the bank now, and there's a kiosk inside where the teller used to be, and I think of the poor woman who's showing people how to work the kiosk that's replacing... her job, So hopefully people can listen to you and our other guests and think for themselves how they can make this, you made so many adjustments along the way without really, without making them noteworthy, but they were pretty noteworthy. Is there something that you think you could tell our listeners that would really, you know, help them make these adjustments, you know, like you did.
Well, one thing that I always like to give that Winston Churchill quote. I'm not sure I've got it exactly right, but it's just very simple. Never, 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 never give up. If you really want to do something, you just have to take the attitude that somehow you're going to make it work. The other thing that maybe an analogy is, you know, throwing yourself into the water over your head and then just forcing yourself to swim mm-hmm. out of whatever you get yourself into, or put yourself on the black diamond slope of the mountain and yeah. figure out how to get down, even though you're not a good enough skier
yeah.
to do it, because yeah. the life threat of actually maybe killing yourself is uh-huh. going to pull the best
the
out of you.
The idea of like
I don't know, but the
Vikings burning the bridges behind them, right? Or
yeah.
Or burning their ships so they couldn't leave. They could only go forward. They couldn't retreat. But also what someone said to me, which I think is very good, and you certainly fit into this, is step one is what you're doing has to be good. In other words, you have to have a good product. And then
yeah.
after that comes all the rest. And your book certainly, you know, obviously very good and very interesting, very exciting. But that goes back to, I guess, with the beginning, where you spent so many hours and so many years actually working on your craft. And that's really, you know, comes full circle, because you run into resistance and you run into obstacles, but you have to really believe in what you're doing is good. Did you feel that? Like, do you feel what's the word? Like, you know, you must feel pride in your work, and you just,
oh, yeah.
like, I know
yeah.
I think, like, I can't believe people aren't reading this. You know what I mean? I mean, you must feel that way.
Well, there is a craft to writing, and you have to learn it. And that was, I think, the biggest thing I got out of working with Richard Marek.
Mm-hmm.
Was,
mm-hmm.
you know, and because it's like if you play golf or anything, you have to put yourself in the hands of your instructor. And I think in
yeah.
the beginning, you can only have one. You can't be reading five different books about writing. You can't
mm-hmm.
have three different
mm-hmm.
editors. You can't take mm-hmm. the advice of multiple people when you're saying, I'm going to put myself totally in your hands. I'm going to let you break me down to the extent I think I'm better than I am, and then build me back up. But also do that with the right person, with someone who has established that they are very knowledgeable about whatever it is you're trying to learn how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the craft is really important. And look, I can't tell you I'm the greatest writer in the world, but if I could write better than I do, I would probably write literary fiction, in which case I probably wouldn't sell any books, or not
yeah,
many of them.
Yeah, that's true too.
I like to read thrillers, which is why
yep.
I've read, you know, I was an English major, I've read tons and tons and tons of literary fiction, which is basically what you read as an English major.
Yeah, yeah.
But because I like to read thrillers, I decided, and I knew enough about publishing to know,
mm-hmm.
you can't write a nonfiction book and then three fiction books that are different
yeah.
genres completely and ever get a reputation, because, I mean,
yeah.
some people can do that, but basically
mm-hmm.
you got to pick your spot.
Yeah.
And so I picked thrillers because that's what I
yeah.
like to read. And
yeah.
so I needed to find a thriller editor who could teach me the mechanics and the structure of
mm-hmm.
writing a thriller.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
So,
That's very good. You know, a lot of people say, you know, women read a lot. The majority of readers are women. Why don't, you know,
yeah.
people have said to me, why don't you write stories focused towards women? And you know, and I'm like, well, it's not what I do. So you have to be true to your art form or your craft in some way. And I think that comes through when people read it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't write about stuff you don't know anything about either. You can't just do
yeah.
research on the internet and say, I'm going to write about this, because you're never going to get it right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
in all of my books, there's some element of my former investment banking
yeah.
career.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Even though you might not think that from an espionage thriller, but there always is. And I mean, for example, my first book, Trojan Horse, the lead male character is an oil and gas investment banker on Wall Street. And he falls in love with this exotic woman who he turns out is a spy. And then teams up with her because her mission is to try and stop a Muslim terrorist plot to cripple the world's oil capacity. So there's a lot of stuff about there. I wasn't an oil and gas investment banker, but I know enough about it. And there's a lot of stuff about deals, which I know a lot about. So there's always an element of my books that goes back to my days as an investment banker. Okay. I don't think you can write about stuff you don't know anything about.
Yeah,
you can't just say, I'm going to write this kind of story. Yeah. Or you can't write the type of book you don't like to read.
Yeah, and a big thing
you have
also
contempt for,
that's true too. Yeah.
If you have contempt for commercial thrillers, then you're not going to write a good commercial thriller because you're going to feel like it's beneath you.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember it's very funny. My first wife used to read Robert Ludlum and Elmore Leonard when we were on vacation.
Okay.
And I was a former English major, and I would read literary fiction, and I always kind of looked down my nose at her.
Yeah.
Not at her, but at the book she was reading. And then I started reading thrillers, and you know, these are two of my favorite authors.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's something. Yeah. I remember once I was on vacation, I chose to read Angela's Ashes. I remember halfway through it, I'm like, what am I doing? I'm in the Bahamas.
I thought it was a great book.
I read our kids starving to death, you know?
It's not an uplifting book for reading while you're on vacation.
No, that was not vacation. That wasn't a summer beach book, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's it is interesting. It's true that you have to. And the other thing is, I think, in writing, and it's the same in music, whatever, you know, like in writing, the language has to be right. The words have to be right. In other words, you have to know the language of the financial industry, or you have to know the language of police procedurals or spy. But tell me about the Sasha books. Now, how did that come about? Here you are, you're writing these financial thrillers and well-established, and then you write these spy, which I love. I love the Sasha books. How did that come about? How did you start writing those?
Well, the first book was Trojan Horse.
Yes.
So that was the first one I put out.
And she was the spy in the
And that book is still by far my best selling book of all time. I think I've sold. You asked me the other day when we were at lunch. It was. I don't have the final math. I do keep track of this, but I haven't updated it in a while. I sold overall, I've got 7 novels and 1 book of short stories and 1 Sasha short story. I've sold somewhere between 350,000 and 400,000 books overall.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And since 2011 when I started. But I have 150,000 of those are Trojan Horse.
Wow.
So part of the reason I kept writing them, even though I did have to do a lot more research for those books than I do for my Wall Street more financially oriented stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll come back to that because my financially oriented stuff is not that financially oriented anymore. Because people like the character.
Uh-huh.
And so I want to continue that series until I decide I don't really want to write those anymore. And I haven't gotten to that point. That's the one I'm working on now. Because it has a following, that particular character, and the big international espionage thriller
has
a following, and that's a big category too. And interestingly, my Wall Street oriented stuff, you made the point that you have to know the language and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I found early on, and I used to read Tom Clancy a lot too. You know, and you get into these really technical descriptions about how this laser guided bomb works. I would get into the deal technology to the point where, you know, even financially sophisticated people would have their eyes roll back in their head.
Yeah.
And I realized that you just can't load a book full of that gunk.
Yeah, I know.
Because you're just going to turn people off. They're going to not understand it. They're going to get bored by it.
Mm-hmm.
So increasingly over time, like Spin Move, which is my latest, and Mickey Outside, which was released before that, are financially oriented characters doing things that are in the financial realm to a great extent, but there's not a lot of technical, you know, detailed finance stuff in there because I want them to be approachable to the average person.
No, absolutely.
And I think,
I remember Mickey Outside, I think, in what
really
I read,
about the
art take, my take. Yeah, well, not only that, but it really was almost, I hate to say this to a famous thriller writer, but it was almost like a love story, wasn't it? Like he did
all
of this.
There's
right?
a love story
yeah.
in the middle of it, yeah. And then there's also
yeah, but
a B story.
He sort of went through all of, he went through to get back with the girl, didn't he? Right?
Yeah.
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 Well, he ended up with the girl. Well, that's good. Now, I don't know if I'm hurting people.
That's a spoiler.
I don't know if you're here by saying it, but I thought it was really interesting of you. So, let us know, or let the listeners know where they can find your work and what you do and what's going on with you now. Oh, just let me ask one thing about the new Sasha book. Now, I think that you like writing her because you like her. That's
yeah,
the way
yeah.
I look at it. Okay. So
who wants to write
that,
about a character you don't like? Who wants to read a character that's not likable?
So give us a little insight into what's going on with her now.
Well, she in Trojan Horse, she's working for the Saudi secret police,
mm-hmm.
and she's working undercover, and she meets this guy Daniel, and they fall in love. And part of the reason that she met him was she was targeting him because she knows that these guys are going to try and infiltrate through the oil and gas business, and they think he may be one of the ways they're going to try and get their way in. So she meets him, and they fall in love. They save the world. In Arab Summer. It's a couple of years later,
mm-hmm.
And there's a separate plot by these same terrorists to topple the Saudi government.
Mm-hmm.
So she's hired freelance by the CIA to go in there and help them stop that.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, which I'm calling On Home Soil, it's my working title, ISIS has gotten to the point where they now want to export their terror to the West, and they send one of their top guys to the U.S. To build a network of cells so that they can start taking it directly to us over here. So she
mm-hmm.
comes out of retirement again with her boyfriend or lover
mm-hmm.
To help stop that, and that's how the book progresses, that she's, that's her current mission.
So it's all going to take place here in America, right?
This one's going to take place here, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of international scenes, too. I mean, there's scenes in Saudi Arabia, France, but most of the action takes place over here.
Yeah. Well, see, one of the things that I find in your books that you're really good at writing is action scenes. Like, my takeaway from Bull Street was that the chase around Park Avenue, where the circle around Park Avenue was. I remember that scene. I remember from Arab Summer, the big gun battle at the mosque and the chase through the streets and jumping in the
mm-hmm.
trucks and things like that. Yeah, you really write that very, very well. So,
yeah, you've told me that before, and thank you for that. I was a little surprised to hear you say that because I work really hard on those scenes. And they don't come that easy to me.
Uh-huh.
So it's gratifying to hear that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about where people can find your new stuff and your old stuff and, how people could get to know you better.
It's easy. The easiest thing to do is either go to my website, davidlender.net, and everything's there, or just go directly onto Amazon. And in the search field, type in David Lender, and I'll pop up. They have an Author Central page, and my novels will pop up. Or you just go to my Author Central page by typing in my name, and you can see all my novels in there, all my stuff in there, just the novels. I have some short stories and stuff.
Okay. All right. I would recommend listeners to go grab one of your books and just, read it, enjoy it. It's the summer, sit on a chair and read one of David's books. So
thank you.
We're going to wrap up. Thank you so much, Dave, for being here. I really appreciate it on my first show. You've been a great guest. I do want to end the show with some closing words.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't the
first
show.
Before you do that, just
let
me thank you. Let me thank you and the show for having me on. I've enjoyed it.
Oh,
and thanks, listeners, for listening.
Yeah, and I'm going to see you soon. Soon we'll have lunch. Maybe a drink instead of lunch. How about that?
Okay. All right.
Okay, good. All right. I just have a few closing words for the end of the show. Inspiration can come from anywhere. Recently, after reading from my latest book, a gentleman came up to me and said, "Your story has inspired me to start playing the saxophone again. I don't care what my wife says." So I thought that was pretty cool, since I'm bringing music into the world and I'm annoying a woman who isn't my wife for a change. My hope is that this show will motivate you to pick up that old sax or guitar or a pen or start working on the keyboard. Doesn't matter how you express yourself, as long as you do. It's time. Be selfish. Do that thing you always wanted to do. Don't let guilt get in your way. I spent years trying to justify devoting so much time to writing when I could have been doing something more productive, maybe something that would have made money, but I was wrong. Since I started writing, my private equity practice has doubled. By spending some time each day doing something you love, you're giving yourself a gift. Not only will you always have something to do, you'll always have something you want to do. And when you're fully engaged, when you're excited to start your day, it will flow through all of your activities. So do something you love. Do it for yourself. You deserve it. For now, don't give up your day job, but don't ever give up your daydream. With this first show, there are a lot of people I have to thank and a lot of credit to be given out. First is the music credits. Thank you to our composers, Chris Martin and Jeff Harvey. They've been creating music for over 15 years and are highly experienced in all areas of commercial music, with numerous TV credits in North America, Europe, and Asia. They work in studios in Leeds and Manchester in the north of England. We want to say thank you to them for providing the music for today's broadcast. To learn more about their work, you can visit them online at purpleplanet.com. I would also like to give a special thanks to Rich Gelhausen and Lady Sela for their support, and I know they're probably listening in, ready to jump in if I make a mistake. I hope I made them proud, but thank you guys so much. Don't Give Up Your Daydream is managed and directed by Storytellers Campfire Radio Programs. You can visit online at storytellerscampfire.org, then click on the show page. And if you have any questions or would like to contact me directly, go to johnnuckleauthor.com. That's johnnuckelauthor.com. Leave a message and I'll try to get back to you. You can also view my articles and blogs or even check out some of my books. Thanks for listening and be well.
Learning and good nutrition does not end when school lets out. The USDA's Summer Food Service Program helps provide nutritious meals to children in low-income areas so they're better fueled with healthy food to learn and grow. To learn more about sponsoring a feeding site in your community, go to www.summerfood.usda.gov.